Good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and we're here with another of our virtual events. And today we have a kind of a global event. Elizabeth Demariafi, the author of the brand new book, The Retreat, is joining us from Newfoundland. And let's see here, Maria Hummel, the brand new book, A Lesson in Red. And you're joining us from Vermont, correct?
Correct, yeah.
All right, well, Barbara and I are both in Arizona, but we're just at different locations. I'm here at the bookstore, at the mothership, and Barbara's at her home office. And for those of you watching, I will be monitoring the Facebook comments field. So if you have questions for Elizabeth or Maria, please don't be shy, put them in the comments field at any time during the program, and I'll reemerge from the shadows about 45 minutes in to ask any questions you might have. So Barbara, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Patrick. Not only is this an international event, but we're going to visit the arts because we're going to be talking ballet and we're going to be talking art in an art museum. So that'll be different from serial killers, the sort of dark things that we often wind up talking about. So I'm really pleased about that. Elizabeth's book, The Retreat, does involve it's kind of not a locked room mystery. It's really more of an Agatha Christie style closed room mystery at Highwater Center for the Arts, and lots to do with ballet. And those of you who are paying attention to our calendar will know that Megan Abbott has a new book coming out, also in the world of ballet. And Tasha Alexandra, who has studied ballet, is going to be talking to her. So I took ballet lessons when I was a kid. I don't know if it ever did me a whole lot of good, but it's exciting to venture into that world. And it's a world filled with a lot of pain, isn't it, Elizabeth, and determination. You can't easily be a ballerina without a lot of physical and mental toughness.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to be driven by so much ambition, and I think ambition that will override the physical exhaustion and the competition, you know, especially as you move into professional dance. Absolutely.
Right. So it'll be interesting to hear your thoughts about why you chose this particular background. I've often thought that looking at ballerinas' feet was a pretty excruciating experience. Are you a dancer yourself?
I am not a dancer. I have a couple of friends who have both been part of professional dance in one way or another, one of whom runs her own company, which is what my character Maeve wants to do. But I am a lifelong long distance runner. And I think I was able to sort of bring some of that physicality and that sort of drive and then all the like aches and pains, I think, from that experience.
Wonderful. There have been some confessional kinds of books about ballerinas lately. I'm trying to remember. I think there's a new memoir by someone who's counted that there's a lot that goes on in the world of ballet besides, you know, the gorgeous dancing and the beautiful costumes. So anyway, we'll talk a little bit more about that. Maria, my sister, was a real star in the art world. She was the associate director of the Museum of Modern Art up until she had retired from illness and then died. So I have spent my whole life in art museums. My husband's grandfather founded the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, formerly the Rosenwald Museum. So I really enjoyed your art museum in Los Angeles, right? And I thought Still Lives, which was a Reese, I never can say this word right, Reese Witherspoon. Why do I have trouble with this name? Reese Witherspoon, Hello Sunshine Book Club selection. I thought Still Lives was terrific. And I was just saying to Maria before we started that I was sorry that we didn't connect when she published that book. But happily, Lesson in Red is a sequel. It carries on from what happened to characters, you know, those who survived in Still Lives, and has a lot to do with the role of patrons as well as the role of artists and museum administration, which is a complicated world and full of big personalities and lots of emotions and big money oftentimes. So ladies, you probably have talked to each other. Would you prefer just to chat? I sort of kicked us off, but since, why don't we do this alphabetically? So why don't we talk to you first? Here, I can figure this out. There we go. The Retreat. So carry us into the world of ballet. And Maria, I'll just sort of sit back and let you ask questions and whatever you like, and then we'll switch.
Okay, that sounds great. Well, I have always wanted to go to Banff, and so I was inspired to read your Crime Reads article about that trip to that art colony and going there with your story idea and then what happened and how it got shaped by your experience. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about that, you know, your expectations of the artist colony and then also what you encountered with that landscape and how that fed into writing the retreat.
Sure. So in the retreat, there's a professional, so my character Maeve is a professional dancer who has recently come out of a difficult marriage, and she's a single mother now, and she has to leave her two kids at home. And she has sort of reached a point in her dance career for a variety of reasons where being a professional dancer, certainly being the highlight professional dancer in a company is not gonna happen for her anymore. And she's decided that what she's going to do is start her own company and be her own artistic director. So she goes to a Banff-like place, is how I describe it. But I had an experience that was not unlike Maeve's, you know, around the same age, where I also was a single mother. I had just come out of a marriage. I was in the early stages of my writing career, and I really didn't want to lose momentum. And I was so worried. I had just recently finished an MFA, and I was extremely worried that I was going to come out of the MFA and then get so caught up in just like the life stuff of, you know, making sure my children were cared for and the mortgage was paid. So I signed up to go to Banff for this 2-week writers program. And I went in October, actually. Maeve goes a little bit later on in the season. But even in October, winter came in really early, earlier, you know, and even people there went, oh, this is really weird. but it was like going down to minus 20 at night. And this is, you know, 12 years ago, I guess, that I went, almost 12 years ago now. So a lot of those, I guess, visceral or atmospheric experiences that Maeve has in terms of the weather changing all the time and the presence of the animals. And so, you know, Banff is a really big place. The center that I imagined, High Water Center for the Arts, I imagine it is somewhat smaller, but it doesn't even matter how big Banff is, because you can stick all this stuff in there and all this sort of human conceit and human-made interest in, you know, creating things, and you're still, you know, kind of in this bowl of the mountains, and there's deer and elk and bears, and you're constantly being warned about not, you know, so you're in the mountains, but please don't go for a walk by yourself, this sort of thing. And in some ways, like if you, in some areas at Banff, you can actually walk into rooms where the facility has been built around the intrusion of the rock face. So to me, this was so interesting when I was at Banff, this sense of you think you're going to the top of a mountain, but you're not really, right? And I think in the book, I describe it as sitting inside a crown with these jeweled peaks all around you. So actually you feel quite small and you feel somewhat oppressed. The days can be quite short because there's the mountain is sort of blocking the sun on both sides. So I got really interested in that feeling of this pressure of physical pressure of nature all around you. And at the same time, everyone who's going there is going for a select amount of time with this highly ambitious project, and it's competitive to get in, it's competitive to get funding to get in, and you get there, and my experience, and I think you see a little bit of this in the book, is that we all got there, and for 2 days, we're like, this is amazing, I'm going to meet all these other artists, and I'm gonna, like, you have all this collaboration and interesting discussion, and after about 48 hours, everyone goes, but I'm only here for 11 more days. And now I have to produce this great piece of work I said I would produce. So not only do you have sort of the pressure of, you know, of this sort of physical world, but I think also the pressure of the art world, of the world for creative people who are, you know, often trying to cram a creative life into into, you know, all their regular stuff. So I don't know if that answers the question.
I haven't been to Banff, but I've been to another writer's artist colony, and you captured that exactly. And I feel like not only is there the pressure to make something, but there's sort of a pressure to perform like you're doing really well at making something, you know, like there is this sort of, you know, you're in sort of this enclosed hive of people, and you have to show that you're looking really busy or successful at what you're doing. And I feel like that came out in the book. I just want to, before I ask my next question, I just want to ask Barbara, because you said locked room versus closed room mystery. What, like, technically, what's the difference? Just that closed room means you can leave?
A locked room mystery is basically an impossible crime. It's set up so that whatever the crime is, the space was so sealed that there's no, you know, it's particularly difficult to work out how the crime was committed. A closed circle is basically, it's kind of an Agatha Christie setup, or it's Rebecca by Du Maurier, where Manderley, the house, you know, encloses the action, or it could be the village that Miss Marple does, or it could be a ship, or it could be a theater, or whatever. So the technical construction of a regular mystery means that you have a crime committed in a circle of suspects, and you have a detective who is either present or summoned, whichever way it goes. And there's a limited number of people who could have done the crime, because, you know, it would be ridiculous to try to interview a universe of suspects. So somehow or other, you have to kind of contain the landscape. And people often say locked room incorrectly, and in this case, it is not. It is the artist colony is that Christie closed up thing. And I was fascinated to hear you say that, because I have spent weeks of my life at the Banff Springs Hotel, and my experience of Banff is just totally different. But let's not go down there. However, you are right about the animals, because one of the things I've always most enjoyed in the swim out pool is that an elk will be attracted by the hot, humid air, and it will come down and it will just lay down by the pool in the middle of all the bathers. And we all sort of work around it. And then they go out on the golf course, which closes in the middle of October. And they come down from the mountains, and the stags get up on the greens, and they fight each other for mating privileges. And you can hear the, you know, the way the antlers clash. It sounds like somebody is playing some kind of instrument or sticks or something. And you can hear them from a very long distance. So I have walked the golf course and, you know, watched these guys do all this. What part of Banff were you in?
The Banff Springs Hotel is right in town, like right on the Bow River. It's a beautiful hotel. And whenever we're there, we walk down and have a drink. If you go a little bit further up the mountain, there's quite a big facility called the Banff Center for I think it's now called the Banff Center for Arts and Creativity.
Okay.
So it's set up almost like, I think it's referred to as a campus almost, with a couple of larger buildings that house artists. So, you know, you might have an entire dance company go and spend 3 weeks working on development and practice. And then there's also these little, what's called the Leighton Colony, which are these very special little cabins that are all very individual. One of them looks like a boat. And they are out in the woods, so you can sort of sign up for a program that houses you sort of within one of these residences, which are really beautiful, or you can actually sign up and also take a cabin where you're not allowed to sleep at night, which is exactly the way the cabins are in the retreat, but that you have this private space that you can go to work on whatever it is you're working on.
I asked because obviously the tourist experience is going to be different than the experience that you went for. And, you know, Banff is a very famous, well-known place. You know, the Rocky Mountaineer will take you from Vancouver to Banff and all. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, no, it's just above the town. So it's about a 10-minute walk into town. And that would be a walk that, you know, you would commonly, you know, be bumping into deer, lots of bear warning signs. I was there in the fall, as Maeve is, on her retreat when it was elk rutting season, which you just described, so the males fight, but also once they have those mating privileges, the elk are really, really dangerous. So you never want to get in between a male and a female, any of the female elks. So we were warned like a lot, not even so much about bears, but about not getting in the way of the elk. Which I just think is like metaphorically really, really interesting that we think about big predators as being the big danger, but in fact, humans have no place there and we can't just sort of stumble through the forest because there's a whole order there that we're not.
Absolutely true. There are herds of cows over on the side of the female elk and you have to avoid them. But Maria, back to your question, your art museum functions as that closed environment, particularly in still lives, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess I wanted to get the terminology right because I was thinking of locked room when I was thinking about Elizabeth's novel, but I see the distinction now. And I'm wondering, one of the things I thought was great about the retreat was I was really guessing to the end, who was the real threat in the story. And that seems to me like the biggest challenge of this kind of book, right? Because you have only a few people, and obviously you have the threat from the from nature happening too. But I wanted to know if you, in your process, how you wrestled with that particular aspect of the plotting, this idea of not giving away kind of who you were going to reveal at the end or what you were going to reveal at the end.
Yeah, that's a really good question because I feel like the book really changed over time as I was writing it. So that to me, there's two settings in the book. There's inside and outside, and each of them have their dangers. And so part of my guiding force in it was for Maeve to always having to be questioning her own instincts and her own self as to where is the dangerous place? Is it more dangerous to stay inside with the humans or outside? With sort of monstrous nature where there's this storm and everything is disoriented by it. When I originally conceived of the novel, I imagined it as much more of a cat and mouse thriller, which would have removed, I think, that last minute question of who is who is really the threat. And then as, we were working on it, myself and with my editors who are both really smart, it just became obvious that it was going to be much more interesting because the story's really about Maeve and her experience in the world and her experience as someone who's come through actually, has already come through a lot of difficulty, has already come through a lot of trauma before she gets here. So in order to do that properly, it was actually much more interesting to create this more fulsome cast of characters. Having said that, I mean, I love Rebecca. I probably have read Rebecca more than any other book in this genre over time, but I also really love In Them There Were None. And so, once I sort of had my cast of characters and I figured out how I wanted to do it, that was very much the feeling that I wanted to get from it. And what I love about In Them There Were None, which I think does both the closed room and the locked room, you know what I mean? Because...
In a way, there are a lot of people who have used And Then There Were None as a template over the last year or two. Surprising number of books have, Agatha Christie was really, it's just astonishing how many plots she created that have been used subsequently. If you think about it, Gone Girl, this whole trust no one genre, it really is the murder of Roger Ackroyd. Mm-hmm. She was the pioneer, in the trust no one narrator. And certainly, And Then There Were None, which had a horrible title, when it was first published, which I shouldn't repeat here on Zoom. But
more than one terrible title, actually.
Really terrible title. It's actually had two. I think this is the third official title, if I recall that right. But yeah, I mean, it is an impossible crime in the sense that, it's only at the end that it's revealed how the whole thing worked. But it's also a closed situation in that, you only have so many people on the island or so many people in your art center.
Exactly, right. And I think that looking at the art center and the mountains as a kind of island unto itself, which is very much how it feels when you're there, you know, because you are like weirdly removed. And so even when we do walk down into town, like it's kind of, it's, you know, now you're living in this place that is sort of halfway between, you know, being among the animals and being a regular person, right? So, because you're so focused on your project and what you're doing. So, so I really thought about it and then there were none a lot. And I really enjoyed that piece of it. What I think is so interesting, and I totally agree, there's been a number of books that have sort of followed this template. And I think it's so weirdly prescient, you know, because I started writing this book obviously long before the pandemic, which has provided this bizarre, you know, enclosed, closed room, claustrophobic feel for all of us. So it's just interesting to see all these books getting released now.
I wonder if, I was thinking also, it's weirdly a climate change narrative too. We're all sort of stuck on the closed room of the world. And you know, I did feel that way, that in your book, that was one thing that I think distinguishes it, is that there is this huge external, I mean, there's often storms and stuff, but your storms are like real. I mean, there's a real sense of isolation and danger created by the wilderness around them, and you know, so that duality of the external internal threat is really, really cool.
Some of the characters notably underestimated too. I mean, there's one I won't name who, you know, makes some notably poor decisions, I think in your book, to an unnecessary conclusion. You know, didn't need to happen if this character had just given more thought to the dangers of climate and so forth. And, you know, we had flooding over the weekend here in Phoenix. It's July when it's normally like 118 and bone dry, and it's 86 and raining. And the store had to close for 2 days because we got flooded. And, you know, I know, it's just that I think we're all used to climatic norms, and, you know, people are dying in Seattle because, you know, we don't need air conditioning, you know, whatever. And now suddenly all of that's changed.
It's all changing so rapidly. It was interesting to me because, so I live in St. John's, Newfoundland, and we get, St. John's is all about precipitation. So we don't get really bad cold weather here, but when we get lots of rain, we get lots of snow. So I'm used to getting a couple of big snowstorms a year. After I'd already written the first draft and we were working on revisions in January 2020, right before the pandemic, we had a storm of the century here that actually shut the city down. The city had to declare a state of emergency for 7 days. So you weren't allowed to drive on the roads and nothing was open, not even grocery stores, like nothing was open. And it was really fascinating for me as a writer who was working on this book, because I watched a lot of the situations that, let's say, have fingers into my story actually play out. And a lot of it had to do with, we're so used to climatic normalcy that we are also really used to a lot of modern convenience, and we're a lot of accessibility to things. So for us, you know, the grocery store is closing for a whole 7 days, you know, lots of people have a storm kit for 2 or 3 days. But after that, you know, you could see the sort of the domino effect of first, the very most vulnerable people in society are going to run out of food really soon, because some people live day to day, right? So if stores aren't open, you see that happen really fast. And then, you know, how it would sort of, you know, move down. And when stores finally did open, it was like craziness. Like there was like, lineups, you know, literally, like a snail shell in the parking lot of people waiting to get in. So, I mean, as a writer, yeah, it confirmed a lot of things for me in a kind of a crazy way, to the point where I would actually during that week, I kept thinking, God, did I do this somehow? Like, have I been thinking about this somehow so much that I manifested it?
Yeah. Did you lose power too?
Some people lost power for days. We lost power briefly, but where I live is, I think we're always trying to figure out, we're either on a hospital grid or on the main police station grid. We can't figure out exactly how it is that we always luck out. We usually only, I think we only lost power for 8 or 10 hours, but there were people who were out of power for days. Yeah.
So Maria, that's a real California experience with the fires and the rolling brownouts and so forth. You know, it's become much more difficult to predict how life will work because we're all used to a constant flow of electricity. I don't know, you know, how we're going to manage if that gets totally. I never used to believe in apocalyptic novels, but now I can see that if the electric grid really went down for a considerable period, that you could get to apocalypse in a big hurry for an awful lot of people. It'd be wild. So Maria, let's talk a little bit about your book. I talked yesterday to Samantha Downing and Megan Miranda, and we were talking about campus mysteries. And, you know, an art museum in its way is not that different than, you know, a Donna Tartt sort of book where you, you know, have put yourself in a place where you've got a lot of hierarchy, you've got a lot of fighting for status, you've got, in some cases, a lot of money, which makes people feel display entitlement to people who are really powerless against that. How did you sort of get into this world of Los Angeles, which is an interesting place anyway for an art museum? What inspired you to write Still Lives?
Yeah, so Still Lives, I worked at the Museum of Contemporary Art in LA for 4 to 5 years. I was the writer editor there, so I did a lot of work directly with artists, interviewing them, and then, you know, writing up things for our magazine and for the galleries and stuff. So I at that time thought, oh, this place is the perfect backdrop for, you know, a mystery of some kind, because the passions run so high, because there's money involved, because there's all the things you said earlier, you know, there's so much, there's glamour, there's intrigue, there's money, there's desperate people, there's, you know, people who have strong moral purpose, but that might get twisted the wrong way, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, so that's where Still Lives came out of. And while I was working there, I thought of some of the twists that would later be in the book, although I didn't write it for many years. I think I needed some time to percolate away from the selfhood and stuff that, you know, Maggie Richter, the main character, who's a copy editor at the museum, isn't 100% based on me, but she's got some percentages of me in there. And I think I needed to be able to see myself from a different phase of life. And then Lesson in Red actually is a campus novel. It's not set entirely on a campus, but I wanted to switch the lens from the art museum to the art school, because I think it's a really high stakes setting. Kind of a stretched version of the artist colony that Elizabeth was talking about, where you have 2 years to do all that sort of proving yourself, you know, and there's people coming in from all over the place, but usually at a much more tender age or relationship to their craft. So they're very excited, very nervous, full of anticipation for what these 2 years could bring, or sometimes three. And I'm talking more about the graduate school experience a little bit than the undergrad one. It's high stakes because a lot of schools, particularly some of the ones in California that I was basing this on, are really expensive. And they don't necessarily give that much funding. So you're making this really high stakes kind of claim to a future that might not happen. And I was just really interested in how those relationships, you know, the relationship between sort of teacher and student, or, you know, the different hierarchies of the school, are an evolution of hierarchical relationships in art history, of master and apprentice and muse. And but they're very, you know, they also lead to, you know, different dangers for people, I think, personally, financially, you know, in terms of their psyche. So, yeah, I do think we're in an interesting campus novel phase too. There's definitely some out right now, like The Maidens, which I haven't yet read. And we're I think almost exactly 20 years from the publication of The Secret History, which is interesting to see the evolution from that book too.
Well, I agree. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, going back to Golden Age novels were written, many of them by academics, if you, you know, Dorothy Sayers being an example. And they were campus mysteries, but in kind of a different way, although Gaudy Night is certainly that kind of a story. And the power imbalances are so severe in both your cases. And also, you know, it's really hard for people, creative people, to go to a place where somebody, where they may be just sort of ordinary, and it turns out other people are really brilliant. I was thinking back to the movie Amadeus. I remember going to opening, well, I don't think it was opening night, but shortly afterward on Broadway, and just being blown away. Mozart's my favorite composer, and I'd never even heard of Salieri. But, you know, I could understand the sort of corrosiveness of, you know, what it would be like to be just a sort of pedestrian composer. And then you're up against a one draft. I mean, you know, Mozart, if you look at his manuscripts, which I've done many years at the Morgan Library and so forth, they're a one draft manuscript. He never even corrected a note. You know, he obviously heard it and, you know, and just put it down in a way that almost no other composer's ever been able to do. And how awful it would be to run up against that, you know, to know that you would never attain that level of genius. You know, what would that do to you? And especially if you're in a place where, you know, you're there to foster your creative talents. And, you know, I mean, it's just like great dancers. I mean, you know, not everybody could be Nureyev or Baryshnikov or, you know, some of the great Margot Fonteyn or whatever. What if you were just an ordinary ballerina, which means you're better than most people, but you're not extraordinary like they are? What would happen to you, you know, if you're in that position where mm-hmm. you know you can't ever be the equal of, you know, somebody?
And I think that for so many artists, and I really felt this in your books, Maria, that there's like a dual stakes that are at play. And I think you've already touched on it a little bit, but so not only are you competing on this level, this artistic level, but there's so much investment that has to go into an artistic career, and the possibility of actually, you know, being financially independent within that artistic career, you know, is tenuous at best. And, you know, so certainly in the visual art world relies so much on collectors and patrons and people with a lot of money. And then you go to an art school and there's this automatic inequality between the professors and the students. And exactly the way you describe it with, you know, a long history of masters and apprentices and how that really makes one group of people much more vulnerable to the others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think it's like we're in an American experiment, which I think is in one way amazing, which is it used to be to become an artist, there were, you know, you'd have to find a patron or you'd have to, you know, go move to a city and kind of live in a tenement for a while till you, you know, somehow sold some work. And now there's this sort of like you can get a ticket kind of to go somewhere, you know, it's partial scholarship or just an acceptance, and people will call you an artist and they will give you those 2 years of time, whether it's through loans or through, but so I think it's opened up the possibility for more people to choose art as a potential career. But then on the other hand, these MFA programs graduate, you know, thousands and thousands of people every year, and how many of them are actually going to make a viable living as an artist, and how 2 years isn't very long. Like, it's not long enough for anybody to really develop their craft. So only the geniuses, you know, do, and sometimes they have, you know, personal problems. So I think, and that was something, so the character who's, this isn't giving anything away, the Brene Brazil, the character who's kind of at the heart of this story, the enigmatic character who was found shot dead in her studio by her own gun. And, you know, some people think there's more to the story. You know, she's the figure of that genius, you know, like somebody who seems to have gotten it all together in terms of her, you know, being able to kind of position herself as a student to break out. But then on once you start looking more closely, you see she's a first generation college student, you know, the something that, you know, really struck me from my time working at Stanford was that people who are first generation college students just are out of, you know, fish out of water compared to the students who've been groomed there, you know, but you know, their whole lives by elite programs and stuff. And it's very hard. It's like a very, very challenging experience. So I wanted to reflect some of that in the story.
Can I ask you a strictly craft question? Because I'm so fascinated by sequels.
Yeah.
When did you know right away that you were writing, and I think that you're thinking of this as a trilogy, if we're lucky. Did you know right away that you were writing a trilogy? Did you come into it like that? Or did you start writing and start to feel like there was more story?
No, I don't know at what point in the first draft I decided I was probably going to write three, but I had this idea that I wanted to do that because I wanted to see how, I didn't feel, well, I felt like I wanted to shift the lens on this art world, you know, LA art world, California art world. And I you know, just one book wasn't going to be enough. So art museum, art school, and then hopefully artist's colony, not resembling yours at all. So no, I did have the sense that it would grow from this story. It is still, I've found to be amazingly difficult, more so than I think I anticipated, because the mystery structure is so defined in some ways. And so it has a little bit less malleability than some other structures for a middle novel. But I did want to do that. Yeah.
Plus, if it's a sequel, you're stuck with all the things that you put into the first book.
Yeah,
you did your world building basically in book one, and then you have to carry it forward. So it's a bit different. I wanted to ask you about trendiness, because you think, I mean, I do anyway. I'm actually a Stanford graduate, and when I was there, which was a long time ago, there was a very great difference between Northern and Southern California. San Francisco was in a completely different city than Los Angeles. So I still think of LA as, you know, very trendy, and oftentimes what might be successful in the art world is not necessarily even good art. You know, it just happens to catch a train, so to speak, of something going by. Whereas the ballet world, Maria, you know, is a much more classical world. You know, I mean, there are differences, obviously, but there's a classical tradition that I think is hard to break through. So do you think, Maria, as part of your, you know, do you think the trendiness of LA is, you know, one of the engines that drives your story?
Well, I guess I would tease out sort of two aspects of trendiness. One is kind of a future forward, or a what's next kind of attitude, which I think is pervasive in LA and actually kind of delightful in a lot of ways. And then there's the other sort of thing that LA gets accused of, which is superficiality, or, you know, an attention to appearances. I personally think that LA, yes, there was a performative kind of showy aspect to some LA art that got famous. But on the other hand, because it had cheap studio space, because it had places where people could afford to live and artists could afford to live, as opposed to New York in a lot of ways and opposed to San Francisco, it's changed somewhat. I feel like it had a really vibrant art culture simply because it was a place where people could live and make work. And they could make it, you know, not earning that much money themselves. Now, I think it's shifted a lot now that downtown has gotten so, I mean, the extremes in downtown have have both gone up, like the homelessness and the high end aspects of it. And I think that's filtered out through lots of the city, but I don't know. I did like poking fun at some of the superficiality in still lives, because it is, you know, it is interesting to have so many conversations with people about their facelifts and stuff like that. On the other hand, I felt like I met people in LA who were just true originals in so many ways that would have a hard time. There's more conformity in other cities sometimes. And LA is one of those places where people can be whatever they want. And it leads to some really, you know, interesting, original self-presentation and also work. So I don't know. I guess I would love to turn this to a dance question, because I'm curious about, you know, Maeve's relationship to her work and where you sort of, like, if you could imagine where she's going to go from this book in terms of her work and stuff. Do you see her changing what she's making? It seemed like she was kind of hinting. I don't know. I don't want you to give too much away either, but.
I think what I was really getting at with Maeve was how much her identity was, you know, her identity was wrapped up in what she did creatively, which I think is true for everyone who has a creative career, for sure. And it's harder to separate, you know, who I am from what I do. And with dance, so much more so, because the physical body is deeply implicated. You know, that's all there is to it. So for Maeve, who's 34, what is a really normal or normalized, for better or for worse, operation for most women. She's had an emergency C-section. For, you know, as I said, we've kind of normalized this, but for a dancer, that's a career ender. Because those core muscles can't be recovered to the extent that she would need them to be. So I think she's facing down age at an earlier age than most women need to. And she's facing her physical identity as her professional identity, as her creative identity all at once. So to me, that was why dance was going to be so important to that character. And I think, you know, I think we have a cultural sense of the ballerina. You know, I watched Black Swan a number of times while I was writing this book, just because I so enjoyed the psychological aspect, the depths to which that character is so much in her own head, and she's, you know, in some ways her own enemy, right? So I just thought, to me, that was going to be really interesting, that we have this sort of superficial, again, kind of sense of the ballerina as just being pretty. But actually, like, so in the book, I continually, Maeve uses the word athlete to describe herself, because of course that's what she is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm trying to think, I had some other questions for Elizabeth. Let me just look at my notes here. I guess something I've been thinking about with writing, you know, books that are about fear, you know, or that have fear as a major component, is that I'm always trying to zero in on what about my character scares me, right? Like, not, it, you know, my central character, the one that I want readers to side with, the one that I side with. And I'm curious, what scares you about Maeve? Like, what about her? Maybe it's not something she becomes, but could become, or I don't know. Did you have any thoughts on that?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think for Maeve, she's got this single-minded drive around dance, and around her own physicality and her own creativity, that if she was able to apply that to everything else in her life, she would be completely unstoppable. She's also come out of a situation where she's have lived for many years with a kind of terrible gaslighting. So her difficult marriage, as I phrase it, was with her artistic director. So somebody who really was very controlling, controlled her professional life, controlled her personal life. And it's really messed her up. And that takes a long time to recover from. So she's in this place where, you know, I kept sort of looking at her and going, wow, this is someone who can physically just take on so much. And at the same time is always second guessing herself, is always going, but are my perceptions actually accurate? You know, is this, you know, can I actually trust my own instincts? Because I've been told for so long that I can't be. So to me, that's really scary. And I think that's really scary for women, right? That you have somebody who's, you know, deeply successful, highly ambitious, highly proficient, who is still like kind of, you know, has been trained to undercut. And that her big challenge is to really figure that out. She has to figure herself out in order to save herself. And on that note, it's really hard to talk about either of your books, Maria, because there is a sequel situation. So whenever I want to like phrase a question about Lesson in Red, I'm like, oh, but this could potentially ruin still lives for someone. But I was super interested in notions of the male gaze in visual art, because you know, there's lots of different suspects. And so I was really interested in how much were you thinking about that and playing? I mean, certainly, you know, in Still Lives, the focus of the very imaginative art project that is the center of the novel is about rescinding that in, I think, the deepest way. So I'm just interested in how you were thinking about that when you were writing the books.
Yeah, I think I wasn't thinking so much about writing against the male gaze, but just really, I mean, both books came to me as a, in this series and really the third as well, although I'm not really into plotting that one yet, as images of artworks. So the first one being this in Still Lives, the artist who goes missing in the first chapter, her exhibition is of herself. She does basically self-portraits of herself as famous murdered women, and through an intense kind of layered artistic process. And in Lesson in Red, I had the image of, you know, a projection in the desert, a woman like larger than life eating cereal with a loaded gun, and like, who is that person? Why is she there? You know, and knowing when you're watching that woman has died. And I think that what I wanted to do in both of those cases was just climb into the story through the female gaze and not have, or have the female gaze kind of turning inside out our, you know, obsession with sensationalizing violence against women, turning inside out our constant representation of it. Of the dead body, you know, the dead female body, and having these artists who, you know, literally, yeah, like sort of show the seams and turn the garment inside out. And I think that, you know, similar to Maeve, when you were talking about Maeve, what I was thinking about about her scares me a little bit is that she seems so devoted to her work and to becoming the very best version of dancer that she becomes, that she almost stops believing. She almost signs up to have someone else tell her how to do it and is willing to kind of let her artistic director husband choose for her that, because she maybe doesn't believe she could do it herself, but she's so willing to put her art forward that she's even willing to like live in this bad relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think for Brené Brazil and Kim Lord, who are the artists, there's, you know, I'm interested in, you know, the extremity of women's desire to create, and how, you know, as a culture, I think we distrust it a little bit, you know, that there's something sort of cool about being the guy artist who, you know, rolls themselves in a barrel down the street, you know, down dangerous steps, but a little unsettling about women doing it. And, you know, I think it's still a question I'm sorting out in the books, because I may also be falling prey, or at least, you know, finding myself falling into that pothole of, you know, is this okay to be that extreme as an artist?
So I need to call Patrick up from the deep before we run out of time. But I would also say this, that there's a real difference in your books, in the sense that, you know, the ballerina, her body is the art, you know, and it's inevitably going to let her down. I mean, you know, there are a lot of very few really old ballerinas, because your body just wears out. And so she has a time pressure about, you know, you've already pointed it out, that experiences have made it impossible for her to go one way, and now she's choosing another. Whereas an artist, you know, can paint. There are a lot of old artists, you know, who can either sculpt or paint. Mm-hmm. So it's a really different thing if your body is the canvas as compared to canvas. In terms of career expectations and longevity and, you know, ticking clocks and all those kinds of things, which Maeve has to face. It really is a ticking clock for her. Which,
absolutely, yeah.
You know, and plus she's, you know, she's also an abuse survivor, which ate up a lot of the time she had on the clock. So, you know, there's a lot of resentment there, would inevitably be. I just think it's really interesting the way both of you have gone into lives of creative people, in, you know, using the mystery or the thriller format, which is incredibly expansive. Patrick, where are you? I need, come on, Shakespeare time. Come out, Caliban or Ariel, wherever you are.
I'm here, yeah. Fascinating discussion. Let's see, there aren't a whole lot of specific questions, but Anne has a question for Maria. She says, I love books with an art theme. Still Lives sounds like a perfect title for your first book. Did you choose it? Just wondering, there are a few other books out there with the same or similar titles. Did that concern you at all?
Yeah, I know there's Louise Penny and other ones. I think, I decided to title it that title very early on because that was the name of the exhibition in the book and the name that the artist gave her work. And, you know, I like the double entendre possibility of Still Lives, Still Lives. It's hard with titling. I think that you sometimes think you have a really original title and then something comes out that is very similar to yours, and you're just sort of stuck with the fact that you came up with the same cool title as someone else at the same time. So I don't worry about it too much. I wanted something. I was really hoping for. I wanted to go for a spondee. You know, in poetry, that's the double stressed. It's a double stress, and it's very. It's very eye-catching for people to see double stress. So Got Milk is an example from marketing. So I stuck with it.
I liked it as a title. Titles aren't copyrightable either. So, I mean, you could have, you know, 400 books called Still Lives and then figure out how to differentiate them. I think your covers have been, very, look at how colorful this is. Whereas I think Elizabeth's, this is a much darker cover, more in keeping, you know, with the atmosphere that you have in your book. And it's always fascinating to me to see multiple cover ideas, you know, because usually there are. You probably got to see at least two or three from your publisher before they settled on this one. And, you know, I mean, it's a written book, and then somebody has to translate that into some sort of physical representation. And over the years, Patrick and I can both attest to the fact that covers are the thing that often rile our authors the most. They either really like their covers or they really hate them, you know, or they wish they had more input or whatever it is. But covers are surprisingly controversial.
Still Lives and The Retreat, they have that sound of permanence about them. They don't seem rooted in any particular moment. you know, whereas if you had the girl with the still life, so 2014, man. Let's see here. Anne has a good question here for Elizabeth. She says, Elizabeth, you mentioned that you had begun writing your book long before the pandemic. How long did it take you to write it?
I think I started writing in 2018. That's when my last book came out, and I feel like I was tied up with a few other projects. So I probably started, I would say fall of 2018. And it usually takes me about a year to get a full draft of a novel, and which I don't know if that's slow or fast, or I don't really know. And then at that point, you know, I try to keep things pretty close to my chest until I have a really, at least until I'm really close to an ending. I didn't start working with an editor until probably fall of 2019. And then, as I said, you know, when the snowstorm came, we were still working on revision. So it was very timely for me.
We inevitably have questions about, from aspiring writers. Can you both talk a little bit about your writing process and how you get the words done, and what's your routine?
Maria, do you want to go first?
Sure. I do believe in routine. I'm not always able to accomplish it because I'm a mother and have a professor job too, but that is, I think, if you're starting out or if you're even just a couple years into it, routine is probably the very best solution to making progress that I can think of. One piece of advice that I saw once in The Guardian, it was, you know, all writers, a bunch of different writers putting in their best advice. And one of them was the first 7 years are the worst, which I great advice. And then in terms of writing suspense books, since this is a, you know, a book, a conversation about this kind of book, I dream them out in notebooks first, map out the plotting pretty extensively before I start writing, so that I know what I'm going to plant and, you know, what kind of red herrings or themes and characters I'm going to develop throughout.
I would agree with all of that. I really believe, especially, it's easy to say, especially when you're starting out, but like, even for me, like staying on some kind of a schedule, a writing schedule, is really, really helpful, especially because things do interrupt you. So I teach in a couple of different programs, and, or, you know, this year I'm releasing a book, which I'm sure you feel the same kind of, it becomes like its own job for like a month, releasing a book. So that stuff kind of interrupts what I'm supposed to be doing. So even if I have to take a few weeks off, I can kind of come back to it and go, okay, now I know what I actually, you know, how I actually like to work, which is I like to work for, you know, whatever. For me, I try to make it the first thing I do. Now, I'm lucky because I live so far east in North America that I can very easily turn my email off till about noon my time. Mm-hmm. And when I turn it on again, it's like 10:30 in Toronto or New York, and I haven't really missed anything. So I try to do that. In terms of plotting, I do so much more of that now than I ever used to. So, you know, when I started writing, I wrote a book of short stories. And then my first novel, I 100% thought my first novel was going to be like a coming of age novel set in Toronto in the 90s. And it ended up being a thriller because the events that actually happened in Toronto in the 90s were all about fear. And I realized that if I was going to write a story about what it was like, you know, growing up at that time for a girl, that I was going to have to really come face and eyes against that fear. And the best way to do that is to make the reader feel afraid. So that first novel, I really kind of like just so groped my way through. And since then, have become much more plotty. And the book I'm working on now, I have a spreadsheet, and it's so relaxing that I have this spreadsheet, because no matter how many interruptions I have, you know, again, I've had to take a few weeks off. This week, I got to sit down and come back to the novel, and I'm like, what do I need to write again? Oh, yeah, it's right there. You know, these are the things that happen in the next chapter, so I know what to do. And it's actually, it's a huge relief rather than sort of just groping all the time. Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful. You know what? Every writer has a process that works for them, and it can evolve, but it's all on how your mind works. Or I sometimes think superstition enters into it. If it worked for you the first time, why mess with it? But, you know, this question comes up at almost every Zoom we do, and it really is interesting, the answers that we get. And it doesn't really transfer for those of you who ask the question, you know, just because it goes that way for Elizabeth or that way for Maria doesn't mean it's going to go that way for you. You have to find your own process. Is that it, Patrick?
And there are also some really interesting, very unconventional approaches.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, Diana Gabaldone has this elaborate, strange thing where she writes from, you know, midnight to 4 a.m. and then, and she still sticks to that.
That's why there's so many sex scenes in her books.
Probably. Yeah,
right. I'll mention that to her. She does do late night sex scene readings, you know, but she also writes in scenes. And then what takes her forever is to write the connecting, the bridges between the scenes. She writes a scene, then she writes a scene, then she writes a scene over here and a scene over there. And at some point she has to connect them all together. We were talking about this last night. I've known at least one author who starts in the middle of the story. We know people who, you know, I'm serious, you know. And a question, I mean, I've edited probably 800 and some books by now. And one of the things I know is that oftentimes when you get a rough draft, where the story starts is not where the author started it. It might be chapter 3, or you need to take a few things and put them together. So, you know, readers don't always realize books are an evolutionary process until they roll on the press. Up until that moment, you know, a book is malleable. It can change. Various things can happen to it and to stories. And, you know, some books take years to write and some books are, remember the late Robert Barnard, who was one of my favorite authors, British author, incredibly clever plotter and all. And he wrote this one book. I have the most absurd ending. I mean, it's just like out of the blue. It was like pirates or something appeared, you know, from nowhere. And I said to him, what's that, Robert? And he said, well, he said, my deadline was there and I just couldn't figure it out. You know, so that's an example. He's dead, so I can say that without embarrassing him. You know, I mean, they're two-star books that don't have any logical explanation for how they worked out. It was like, I needed pirates, you know, because I only had 2 days to write it. So who knows? Anyway, it's really been a joy to talk to both of you. What a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us. For those of you who've been watching or will watch, there's a podcast available tomorrow that you can recommend to friends, or the Facebook video will live forever. And Patrick is holding up copies of the books. So because, excuse me, Maria's in Canada, and no, wrong one, Catherine's in Canada, Maria was more in reach. We don't actually have, as we often do, autographed copies, but now the Canadian border's open again, you know, we may be able to achieve that with a different book. So thank you very much, ladies, for joining us, and we wish all of you a wonderful afternoon. Thanks for being with us.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.